interim editor of Mosaic.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Adam. He was a pioneer in helping bring back alchemical material into public eye. And I don't know how many of you know, but during the late 70s and the 80s, he published the Hermetic Journal, Hermetic Source Works series of reprints of alchemical texts. And then his work shifted slightly in the 90s. He was given the opportunity to work for the famous Bibliotheca Hermetica, Philosophica Hermetica in Amsterdam. And the owner of this significant library of Hermetic philosophy, Joseph Ripman, invited Adam to become a research associate of the Bibliotheca and gave him the freedom to research in depth the literature of alchemy. And most recently, Adam has expanded again to further publishing, including his alchemy website on the web, which I think perhaps is the exception that justifies the internet that Robert was criticizing the other night. It's a marvelous site with incredible amount of material made available to people all over the world. In any event, here's Adam.
So for this talk, I would like to make a survey of the alchemical material published during Rudolphine Age. Now, I regret I don't really have the sufficient historical expertise to give any new insights into Rudolph's own interests in alchemy. So I must leave such things to others. But I think it'd be instructive for us to look at the alchemical material that was published from the beginning of Rudolph's reign in 1576 up until 1612 when he died. And this will hopefully give us some perspective on just what sorts of ideas were being discussed during this period and introduce some of the personalities who contributed to the Hermetic alchemical tradition at that time. People often make generalizations about sudden emergence of alchemical publishing at certain periods in history, and sometimes mistakenly assume that there was such an explosion of alchemical publishing material in response, say, to the Rosicrucian manifestos. And I've made this mistake myself. Indeed, in a way, the opposite seems to be the case. And the Rosicrucian writings appear at a kind of peak in alchemical publishing. Now, a few years ago, I was able to consolidate various databases of alchemical and hermetic books. And I was able to extract some statistics from this about the publication of these books. Now, statistics, of course, may be thought of as being rather dull, very far removed from the fluid energies of alchemy. But just please bear with me just a minute or two, because they do reveal some interesting things to us. We can see here three main peaks of alchemical printed books. Here I plotted the books against the year. The graph above refers to all alchemy books. That's including all the various editions, the reprints, reissues, etc. Whereas the lower graph includes only the first appearance of a particular work. So it refers to the works rather than the reprintings. But these both show the same consistent pattern with three main peaks of publishing. And the first of these occurs, you can't read it off, it's too small, but the first occurs around 1570. And the second, in the first and second decades of the 17th century. And there's a further one after 1650, which goes on to about 1685. And then we have a gradual falling away towards the end of the 18th century. So, to put this in the context of Rudolf, Rudolf's reign spans the first two peaks. Shortly before he came to power, there was a surge in alchemical publication. And at the close of his life, there was another definite increase in the publication of alchemy and hermetic books. So I would like us now just to take a look at some of the key works. Now, I can only just look at a few, but some of the key works that were published in this era and which shaped the alchemy of that time. And then I want to later on consider the contrivance or the invention of supposed adepts, which we've heard about by a few speakers here, and which to some extent characterizes this era of alchemy. And finally, I would like to look at some of the many stories of transmutations which appeared also at this time. And these things characterize this Rudolfine period, I think. Now, there were at least 621 alchemy books published during the Rudolfine period. That is 1576 to 1612. So we can only really focus here on a few of them. Of course, we must begin with the main figure which dominates this age, Paracelsus. And of course, Robert Bly has nicely, for me, interpreted the Grimm story as a reference to Paracelsus. So Paracelsus died in 1541, before this time, of Rudolf, but it took some years for his writings to be published and for the impact of his ideas to filter down and affect other alchemists and writers. And one of the key publications at the beginning of this period was some of the Latin texts of some of his alchemical works, which were issued by Peter Perna at Basel in 1575, just before Rudolf came to power. Previously, much of Paracelsus was really unavailable in German, but the editing and publishing of his works into Latin began at this time and made them available to a wider audience. And in fact, the major collected works of Paracelsus in German was issued just 14 years later in 1589. So let's look now at some of the Paracelsus who took up during this period his alchemical work and developed it further. Of course, an important figure here must be Gerhard Dorn. Now he issued a compilation of Paracelsus in 1581. And also an edition of some works of Bernard of Treviso a year later. These are just a couple of title pages of some of his books. At this time, he also wrote, of course, a well-known dictionary of terms used in the writings of Paracelsus, which was actually later published in a number of books, sometimes without acknowledging him as the author. As his ideas matured, Dorn began to explore alchemy in a more symbolic manner. He, in such writings as his Key to the Whole of Chemical Philosophy, Dorn had really abandoned naive ideas of chemical transmutation and began to explore the inner symbolic transmutation. His ideas very much influenced the later generation of alchemists. Another important figure was Leonhard Thurmeisser, an interesting personality who led rather a fascinating life and published a number of books which follow up some ideas of Paracelsus. And the best known of these is the Quinta Essentia of 1574, which contains some famous large woodcuts. And this isn't actually from that's Thurmeisser himself. The next slide. Never mind, it probably got out of order. I had a slide from the Quinta Essentia, but it actually appears in the catalogue here on the second page. And interestingly, if you go to the Opus Magnum exhibition, they have the the tournaise or quintessentia open at this particular image. He has been seen by historians of chemistry as being one of the first manufacturing chemists and a kind of entrepreneur who set up business enterprises to provide various substances needed in the society of that time, especially alum and saltpeter, which are used in dyeing and the leather tanning businesses, you know. So he actually attracted to himself some fanciful stories, and I'll return to describing one of these later. Another Paracelsus we must mention is Alexander von Suchten, who especially explored the nature of antimony in his book on the secrets of antimony, which was issued in 1570. Now, his work contributed to the fascination of alchemists of the late 16th and some early 17th centuries with this strange metalloid, which we see focusing in the Basil Valentine writings. And I'll return to looking at Basil Valentine later. Again, later in Rudolf's reign, Paracelsus remained influential, and the emperor appointed a key Paracelsist called Martin Ruland, the younger Ruland, as his personal physician. And Ruland continued some work begun by his father, and he wrote an extensive dictionary of alchemical terms, which is full of incredible gems of information. And this Lexicon Alchemiae was published at Frankfurt 1612, just at the end of Rudolf's life. And this was a key work in the history of alchemy, and it's so often referred to and quoted from by later writers. Luckily, it's been translated into English in the latter part of the 19th century, so it's very, very easily available now. Writer of the Rudolfine period that we must mention is Oswald Kroll, and he died rather young at the age of 29, but in his short life he managed to do a great deal. He was a physician to Christian of Anhalt, and he later a counsel of Rudolf, and his key work was the Basilica Chemica, which was issued in 1609, and this was really one of the main reference sources for information on Paracelsus' medicines and philosophy. So there are many, many others who contributed to the development of Paracelsus' ideas during this period. Duquesne or Cersetanus, Peter Severinus, and others. And later in the 17th century, we have the iatro chemists, such as Daniel Sennert, Angelus Sala, Silvius Tachenius, and others, who they really drew very heavily upon the this material that was being worked over in the earlier Rudolfine period. And a key figure at this time we must consider is Andreas Libavius. He really has to be seen as a kind of transition figure, one who stands in a way on the interface of the alchemical tradition with the soon-to-emerge science of chemistry, which can be seen as beginning to be born in the 17th century. Libavius had a great interest in Paracelsus, so some difficulties with it, and had obviously studied his writings in great depth. But he began to apply a critical intellect to the subject of alchemy. So though he believed still in the possibilities of transmutation, he did not really naively accept the various exaggerated stories which were current in his age. And Libavius is perhaps especially known for the great folio volume Alchemia of 1597, which that's the title page. In this book, Libavius attempts a methodical analysis of the nature of alchemy. Indeed, some scholars, as I say, have recognized this book as the first systematic textbook of chemistry. Now, Klosowski de Rola yesterday in his talk warned us, he wanted us really not to to realize that alchemy should not be seen as the as some scholars do. In Libavius, we see perhaps a kind of struggle going on between his alchemical soul and that part of himself who wanted to systematize in the manner of the later chemistry. He categorizes and tries to provide a clear account of the various processes and activities of alchemy. And most instructive is his idealized plan for the structure of an alchemical laboratory. He would have dearly liked, I'm sure, to have been able to build this. This is actually also in the Opus Magnum exhibition. The Libavius book is open at this page too. So he made some very interesting discoveries in his laboratory, especially he's known for the fuming spirit, which was, in chemical terms, a chloride of tin. And interestingly, the recipe for making this was actually contained in an important early German manuscript, which is dated to 1414 to 18, entitled The Book of the Holy Trinity. I have mentioned this book many times. It's a manuscript, but very influential. Libavius had obviously read widely, and indeed he includes a figure engraved from one of these early manuscripts in this book. So I really have just made a quick survey of a few of the main writers of and writings about alchemy that were important in the age of Rudolf. Now, of course, I've had to choose only a few representative writers, so I must apologize as I really missed out crediting so many others who made important contributions. But in this talk, I'm just really trying to illustrate some key points about the alchemical tradition of the time, rather than providing some kind of, you know, catalogue of books. Another important strand in the writings of this period was that of the allegorical and symbolic alchemy, and the development of alchemy as an interior pursuit. The construction of an allegorical alchemy appears, for example, in the Rudolfine age, in writings such as that of Mazari. The metallic transmutation Three Dreams was issued in three times during this period, in 1572 and 1599. And this book is illustrated with some interesting woodcuts in similar style as the earlier Hypnerotica, the Dream of Polyphilus. And yesterday, John Godwin and I looked at the copy which is in the Opus Magnum exhibition. Now, Beverald de Verville issued a series of works during the closing decades of the 16th century, exploring the inner symbolism of allegories and hermetic ideas, which perhaps culminate in his translation of the, it's not really just a translation, it's a summarized translation of the Dream of Polyphilus, the Table of Rich Invention, which has, it's dated actually 1600 on the famous engraved title page, though some scholars date it to 1610. And Jocelyn Godwin, in the opening talk to the conference, showed us a number of the delightful woodcuts from the Hypnerotomachia in his talk, and he gave us the good news that he's begun to make a translation of the complete work of the Hypnerotomachia, which may just possibly be published close to 1999, which is the 500th anniversary of the first printing of the book. The writings of Gerhard Dorn, which I mentioned earlier, they demonstrate this change really from outer alchemy to the developing perception of alchemy as an interior matter. Henry Conrat was another key figure in the interiorization of alchemical ideas. He believed that the interior work or the meditation in the oratory Mrs. Conrad, must match and resonate with the outer laboratory work. He wrote a number of books during the last decade of the 16th century. His Amphitheatre of Eternal Wisdom of 1595, and his Confession and the Treatise on Chaos, among a number of others. The main edition of his Amphitheatre, which was actually issued in 1609 under the privilege of Rudolf, gave a significant impulse to the development of spiritual or inner alchemy, which was a significant strand of the alchemical tradition throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. Here's the famous oratory and laboratory. And there are actually two copies of the Conrad Amphitheatre in the Opus Magnum exhibition. So you get a chance to look at two of the plates. It's a great problem for running an exhibition of books, because you know you can only open it at one page. But here they have two copies. Another important aspect of the alchemy of this time, and I believe of other aspects of outer culture, was the concern with the recovery of ancient knowledge. There was a sense that the alchemists of a previous generation held the true secrets, which had become lost to that time. And consequently, there arose a need to recover and to publish these ancient ideas and writings. And this may be related to the beginning of the establishment of collections of objects which display something of the wonders of nature that inspired Rudolf and many European princes at that time to set up such collections. And some of these collections actually now form part of the foundations of our major museums. So, we find ancient texts being recovered at this time. Reusner's Pandora of 1582 is a reworking of earlier manuscripts. The Book of the Holy Trinity, I mentioned earlier, early 15th century manuscript, and I mentioned when discussing Libavius. And the Most Precious Gift of God, which is another key 15th century manuscript. Many, many of these circulated, but suddenly in 1582, these are put into print and reach a much wider audience again. In the late 15th century, writer George Ripley, famous for the 12 Gates, it's a very important allegorical work in I must say, rather atrocious English verse. It established a key sequence of alchemical processes, and it had been circulating in manuscript copies during the 16th century, but it was finally put into print in English in 1591 and in Latin in 1599. That's a little page. We also have at this time possibly, pseudonymous works of Thomas Aquinas, Raymond Lull, or Roger Bacon, and these were issued during this period. And in 1602, the first four volumes of the great six-volume compilation of the alchemical tradition in Latin, the Theatrum Chemicum, makes its appearance. This theatre of chemistry really was a major source for such texts to late generations of alchemists, a really very important resource. And it had its foundation, I believe, in the need to recover what was perceived during this period as kind of lost wisdom. And the first four volumes contain actually over 120 treatises. So with this book, this series of volumes, you probably had all you needed as to study alchemy. The title page. That's actually the later. I didn't actually have the first edition on a slide, but it was reprinted later in the 1650s. So the second theme, now we've looked at the books and things, the second theme I wish to discuss as part of this Rudolfine period really arises from a kind of inner need to be in contact with this ancient tradition. And this gave rise to the invention or the contrivance of ancient sources. Now, the invention of such sources by alchemical writers and publishers should not be seen as forgeries. Today, we can come to look in a rather disparaging way at such things as forgeries. And there's even, most people have a tendency really to undervalue anything that they do not perceive to be genuine. A number of people in this Rudolphine period felt it necessary to issue works under a contrived or fictitious author. And although scholars can, by skillful textual analysis and keen historical research into the sources of such books, the scholars can indicate that some authors, even those well known in this time, may be fictitious. We who now study this material should not feel the need to denigrate these as forgeries. In a sense, we have to be charitable towards such works and read them for the alchemical ideas that live within them. To be a true alchemist, one must be able to deal with such enigmas and difficulties, to see the true gold that lies within a smoke of seeming deception and confusion. Thus, one small example is Sternau's War of the Knights of 1595, which is purports to be written by a 15th century Catholic priest of Bamberg, even though there's strong internal evidence that it was written in the late 16th century. Then we have the question of the Basil Valentine series of writings, which first appear in 1599. And the first published work of his famous is the Treatise on the Great Stone of the Philosophers. It contains the text of the 12 Keys, without the illustrations, which we all know, which were actually added in the 1602 and later editions. These were supposedly written by an early 15th century Benedictine monk called Basil Valentine, whose manuscripts were found hidden under a tablet of marble behind the high altar of the cathedral church in the imperial city of Erfurt. An important component of his writings is the focus on the uses of antimony in alchemy. Popular etymology, quoted in most 20th century books about alchemy, still derives the word antimony from the French antimoine, against the monks, or the bane of the monks, suggesting that Basil Valentine, in testing his antimonial preparations on his fellow monks, led to some unfortunate incidents of antimony poisoning. However, this is an apocryphal tale, because the term antimonium was actually found in a work of Constantinus Africanus at the end of the 11th century. So the Basil Valentine writings caught the imagination of the alchemical community, and a number of works were printed in various editions during the first decade of the 17th century. And these especially promoted the uses of antimony in alchemy. These books inspired a whole generation of alchemists who sought in antimony for the key to the work. And although these writings were probably composed shortly before the publication, there is internal evidence quoted by some scholars that they could not have been written in the 15th century. They were obviously written by an experienced and brilliant alchemist who had a key message to communicate, and a message which was very timely. And although the author may be a fiction, the writings themselves are key works of the alchemical tradition. Salomon Trismegistus is invoked in 1598 in a German Paracelsus compendium entitled The Golden Fleece, as the author of a number of treatises, including the famous Splendor Solus. Trismegistus is presented as a late 15th century adept who went on a journey in search of the Philosopher's Stone and later became a teacher of Paracelsus. The Splendor Solus manuscripts themselves, of which seven survive from the early 16th century, originate in the 1530s. There are two of these early manuscripts in Berlin, and most of the later copies were made around the 1580s. The copy in the Bibliothèque Nationale the British Library copy, the Nuremberg, I think, and also the Kassel versions were made in 1580s, round about there. So there is a revival of interest in this particular manuscript around about 1580, and which prompted the making of these copies. I have not had an opportunity of viewing all these copies, but it appears that the ascription of this work to Salomon Trismosin was not made till the printed version in 1598. And the name is really derived from the Greek, Trismosin, the thrice raised up or elevated Solomon, which really just echoes the name of Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice great Hermes. Some scholars actually identify the author as an early 16th century alchemist called Ulrich Poissel. Another adept who makes his first appearance in history at this time would appear to be the 14th century adept Nicholas Flamel. A piece of writing, his Summary of Philosophy, first appears in Gerhard Dorn's book, Trevor Sanus on the Chemical Miracle, which I mentioned above, which was printed in 1583. This was reprinted in the Theatrum Chemicum, and 10 years later, in 1612, the story of Flamel's life and the now famous account of how this lowly notary or secretary, finding and interpreting the Book of the Hieroglyphic Figures, then after a long struggle making the transmuting stone and amassing a considerable fortune which he gave to the poor and sick by establishing chapels and hospitals, it strangely resonates with the myth of the Rosicrucians in the Fama Fraternitatis, which was composed about this time. The historical facts surrounding Flamel are still being investigated, but it's the opinion of some scholars that he was a contrivance of this period with these authors. And that part of ourself which takes inner delight in the material of these texts. But sometimes this struggle can evaporate when we read the texts. For we find there, certainly in the Flamel Hieroglyphic Figures, a true masterpiece of alchemical writing, which produced a beautiful series of manuscripts, mostly from the 18th century, of the sequence of hieroglyphic figures, beautifully coloured, magnificent specimens of alchemical manuscripts. We can generate such a strong inner feeling for the coherence of such a text and images that the question of authorship can seem trifling and unimportant compared with the magnificence of the text itself. So to me, some of these deeply argued points of scholarship are not so important as the writings themselves. As with Basil Valentine, obviously the work of a significant alchemist and the impact of these still resonates down the centuries, even to this day. So, again, we see in this period of the last quarter of the 16th and the early 17th century, the age of Rudolf, it was to some extent obsessed with the need to recover, rediscover the wisdom of the past. And consequently, some publishers were not above giving a text a patina, a kind of surface gloss of supposed ancient history by associating it with an alchemist from earlier centuries whose supposed life story was often overlaid with romanticized aspects. And the last theme I would really like to pursue here is that of the stories of transmutations that were rife in this era. Rudolf himself and other princes encouraged alchemists, and so various people were called upon at times to demonstrate their abilities to make the transmutation. And I have made a special collection of such stories over the years, and maybe someday I might be able to publish these. The Rudolfine age has many such stories. Let us just return to Tourneiser, the writer, businessman I mentioned earlier. We find some stories circulating about a certain Sebastian Siebenfreund, which became linked with Tourneiser. Siebenfreund, sometimes before 1570, entered a monastery where an old monk confided to him the secret of the philosophical tincture. Siebenfreund eventually made the philosopher's stone and began to travel around Germany, performing miraculous cures of the sick and transmuting metals into gold. There's a detailed account of him turning a spoon into gold, for example. Thurneysser and a colleague, Siebold Schwertzer, who had long sought the secrets of alchemy, apparently befriended Siebenfreund, and so the story tells, they later killed him in order to steal his tincture. Schwertzer then appears to have performed a number of transmutations with this stolen tincture before the Elector Augustus in Dresden in 1585, and later in 1592 became involved in some legal struggles with the Dresden court, which actually seemed to have been resolved favorably by the intervention of Emperor Rudolf. So we see that at that time Rudolf had become favorably inclined towards him. Now this story is as related by a much later alchemical writer, Kunkel, in the 17th century, tells that after the death of Augustus, Schwertzer continued in the service of the next elector, Christian, and that many millions of Reichsdollars of gold were added to the treasury at that time. Later, Schwertzer went to Prague and he entered the service of Rudolf, and Schwertzer apparently kept a detailed account of all these incidents, which was published over a century later, actually in 1718, in a German book entitled The Gold Making of Schwertzer. This story is really very complex and is told by a number of later writers, but it illustrates one of the classic transmutation stories, especially the idea of someone stealing or finding the philosopher's stone rather than making it themselves. Schwertzer and Thurneysser both seem to have achieved wealth through being chemical and mining entrepreneurs, and this may have actually occasioned the association of these stories with these personalities. Leonhard Thurneysser, on the 20th of November in Rome, is said to have performed a miracle with a common iron nail. The nail was dipped into the philosopher's stone in some way, and the iron, so far as it was immersed into this liquid, was transmuted into gold, all of which was solemnly testified by a cardinal of the church. And this may have been the simple replacement into solution of a more electropositive element, which is commonplace to inorganic chemists today. But it may reveal something of Thurneysser's grasp of the chemistry of metals. To people of that time, this form of chemistry was indeed a strange, mysterious transmutation. A few years later, Edward Kelly traveled with Dr. Dee to Prague. Kelly, of course, we all know was Dee's assistant in a long series of magical experiments, and Dee was really well known throughout Europe for his Monas Hieroglyphica, a key hermetic work on the inner mathematical foundation of symbolism, which had been first printed in 1564 and dedicated, in fact, to Rudolf's father, Maximilian. And it was later reprinted in 1591 and also included in the famous Theatrum Chemicum of 1602. Nick Goodrick Clark, of course, discussed Dee's contribution in some depth. And when in Prague, Kelly's interest in alchemy and his confidence in being able to perform the transmutations began to grow. And when Dee left to return to Britain, Kelly remained behind to pursue an alchemical career. And some books were later ascribed to him, and a number of alchemical manuscripts and letters seem to have survived. These are some of the woodcut figures from his Theatre of Terrestrial Astronomy, published much later, actually in 1672, and we don't even know if it was actually written by Kelly, but it was associated with him. At first, Kelly's demonstrations of transmutations seemed very successful, but later his reputation seemed to decline, and it appears that he died as a result of attempting to escape from imprisonment. And I'll not dwell long on Kelly, as others at this conference have taken this up in some detail. Suffice it to say that many stories of transmutations circulated around this strange and enigmatic trickster-like personality. Stories became heaped upon stories, and accounts of Kelly's alchemical activities were still being written well into the next century. It was even said that Kelly discovered a supply of the tincture in the ruins of the church in Glastonbury. To end my discussion of transmutation stories, I feel I must deal with the confused tale, which is very important in characterizing this time, and also mentions Rudolph. These are the stories of the Scotsman Alexander Seton and the Pole Michael Sendivogius. And these have come up quite a few times. These two figures have come up quite a few times in the conference so far. The stories about these two characters became so conflated, sort of tied together by later generations of writers. It's now very difficult, without new research, to decode the truth about what happened. Indeed, I myself have been unable to uncover any evidence in Scotland for the existence of Alexander Seton. Yesterday, Klosowski Derola told us the story of the alchemist Seton, who, having made the stone, travelled in 1601 from Scotland to the continent, and in a short meteoric career demonstrated a number of transmutations at Enkhuizen in Holland, at Zurich, Strasbourg, Frankfurt, Cologne, Hamburg, Munich, among other places. Finally and tragically, he came to Dresden, where he was eventually imprisoned by the Elector Christian II and tortured, but refused to reveal the secret of his powder of projection. These stories tell how he was then rescued from this imprisonment by Michael Sendivogius, but died shortly after from his wounds. Sendivogius is then supposed to have acquired Seton's powder of projection and embarked on his own career of public transmutations. And strangely, these things echo the stories about him. Echoing the stories about Seton, Sendivogius himself was imprisoned by the rival alchemist von Muhlenfels, and actually managed to escape from imprisonment after 18 months of captivity. So here we have other layers of stories confused. The story is told of Sendivogius making a transmutation before Rudolf in 1604, at which Rudolf himself was actually allowed to make the projection of the tincturing red powder. Rudolf was so impressed by this that he had a marble plaque fixed to the wall of the chamber recording the event with the inscription, "Let somebody else do what Sendivogius of Poland has done." Of course, our sources for these stories are much later, and these later writers each had their own angle or slant to put on the events. Indeed, those stories seem to be told in order sometimes to make some moral point. And scholars, you know, struggle to deconstruct the layers of interpretation or the muddled refabrication of these stories. They, in a sense, are more archetypal sometimes than real. As an example of how difficult it can be to tease out the facts, the very important text, The New Light of Alchemy, which is one of the most important and influential books on alchemy in the 17th century, is said in some of the stories to have been originally written by Seton. But we just don't know. It was actually published by under the name of Sendivogius, under his elaborate permutating the letters of his name. The text really wasn't published under the name of Seton until 1751, 150 years later. But the first edition in the name of Sendivogius was printed at Prague in 1604. Not in the name of Sendivogius, but in the permutation of his name, hidden in an anagram. Sendivogius also wrote some other works, not differing significantly from The New Light. So some scholars believe it's not necessary to invoke another author. Now, very interesting, Raphael Prenker, in his workshop yesterday, surveyed the historical facts known about Sendivogius and introduced me to the existence of a number of key documents, some actually here in Prague, which throw light upon this complex tangle of history. So I do hope that Rafael one day will be able to write this, extensively on documenting this matter and presenting us with this new material, which is at least new to me, and I'm sure to many of my colleagues, about this important matter of Sendivogius. So, the transmutation stories of this period so often reflect a kind of archetypal tale with a moral lesson for us. Some are, one suspects, didactic rather than factual, meant to instruct us in some way and not to record actual history. And they are, like all good stories, also very entertaining. They are evidence for the ways in which later writers have sought to shape, image, and mold our perception of the personalities of alchemists. There are certainly a quixotic and elusive aspect of alchemical literature, but deeply fascinating. And parallel to the appearance of these transmutation stories is the casting of medals to commemorate an important transmutation. Let's look at the next slide. Yeah. This particular medal is dated to 1609, and there are copies preserved in Vienna at the Kunsthistorisch Museum and in the German National Museum in Nuremberg. Some of these medals are supposed to be made actually from transmuted metals. A number of such medals still exist, and they have been extensively documented over the past decade by Dr. Vladimir Karpenko, who lives and works here in Prague. And I mean, one of the delights of coming to this conference has been meeting people and exchanging ideas. And one of the highlights for me was, on my coming to Prague, was to meet Vladimir, and who is actually unknown here in Prague. And he's written so much and studied so much on these matters. Even during the difficult years of the 1980s, when books were really not available to him much, you know. So, he has studied and made a list of many of these medals, and I hope to be able to publish some of his articles later on these alchemical coins and medals. There's so much more to be discovered about alchemy, and so few people have the opportunity to immerse themselves in the literature and the manuscripts and printed books. So with this, I want to just bring this short survey of alchemy of the Rudolphine period to a close. I hope I've been able to show a little bit of the richness of alchemical literature, which is regrettably still much neglected and ignored. I hope I have been able to indicate that the invention of alchemical adepts does not detract one jot from the power of these writings. I also hope that the various stories of alchemical transmutation can have subtle subplots that are themselves interesting and instructive about these times, even for those who do not take these tales literally. All of which leads me to the conclusion that there are great treasures lying unexplored and still to be found in the literature of alchemy. Ralph says we can have 5 minutes of questions before the next talk. Yeah? Well, they need a microphone because they want to record the question.
Who would like to ask a question?
Jonathan.
Let me say first, I realize the folly of asking such a question, but just for entertainment value. I came across a citation, I don't recall the location of it, connecting Alexander von Schuchten, whose writings are so precious to practical operators, identifying him as Alexander Seton. Have you heard that anywhere?
Well, yes, this is one idea. I mean, scholarship, various scholars have still really to work over much of this material. There's so few people have the opportunity really to study these things in depth. And you need to look at, I mean, Raphael Prinka is trying to investigate Sendivogius, and he really needs access to libraries in Prague, all over Europe, too, because this material has been dispersed very much. And although in key libraries like the Bibliotheca Philosophica Hermetica, there has been an attempt to bring things together in one place, it's still very much spread out. And so you need an enormous amount of time to go around looking at these things. And so scholars often have to make judgments without all the information. And so there are a lot of these questions really need much more research before they can be finally solved, you know. We only have impartial answers.
Excuse me, of course I could ask Professor Karpenko himself, but you know, the other people to learn where these metals, the gold of the metals, actually examined chemically for trace elements, the way of crystallization, or so on?
It can be. I mean, there are obvious ways. Actually, chemically, all gold, all substances on the earth have a kind of signature of where they're found, because they have a, if you put them through a mass spectrometer, you get a distribution which, and when gold is stolen and it can be melted down by criminals and cast into different ingots, but you can still identify if it's South African gold or wherever, you know, because it has a different isotopic mix. But I don't think the resources have been available for people to do these experiments with these alchemical coins and medals. I wish it had been, but...
More
yes, but I mean, it's difficult to do, to get museums and everybody to take this thing seriously. Maybe one day.
I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about one author which has been cited or mentioned twice during these days. It is Beroald Verville. And I would like also to recall that you said that the réseau of alchemists is international. So we have to speak also about the French alchemists,
oh, sure,
which were very important. It has been said that the tableau des riches inventions is a summary of the Songe de Polyphile de Colonna. I would like to correct just a small thing. It is not a summary. It is, on the contrary, an extensive translation redone after the translation of Jean Martin, who was the first translator. And I would like to call your attention upon the preface of this wonderful book, which is called Recueil Steganographique, which is a very, very important manifeste alchimiste, which is, if you can project the slide on the tableau,
no, we can't go back.
Okay, which is the commentary of the frontispiece you have projected, and it is a very, very important manifest which I studied in my last book, but I think that it has to be studied much more,
sure,
because it is revealing a lot of information on French alchemists. Another just small thing I would like to add is the fact that we are dealing with texts of alchemist, on alchemist, and we don't deal enough on the forms of that text. And their forms are very important, because you spoke about allegories, and the allegory is one of that form of text. We have, for example, travels, which is the most common form of narration of that story.
Sure.
We have dialogue, we have treatise, we have essay philosophique. So each genre has to be, I think, mentioned differently and is the...
I really put it onto my website, because so I'll try and do that over the next few weeks. Okay. Thank you. There you go.